There was a great song by Steely Dan when one of the lines went, I cried when I wrote this song, sue me if I play too long. And I kind of feel that's where I'm at right now. It was a long night last night. I kind of got lost in the reading that I was doing to prepare for this morning. And it's possible I have a little too much stuff. So we'll just see how it goes. I really want to take you on a journey. It's a continuation of where we were last week. And for those of you who weren't with us last week, we were talking about we as humans, our basic and most deepest fears are the fear of aloneness, the fear of being alone. It's like you scratch anybody and underneath there's this scared child in the dark looking for a hand to hold. That insecurity, that basic human existential insecurity is what drives so much of what we do in life. The dysfunctional things, you know? The codependent things, the enabling things, the addictive things and compulsive things are driven by this insecurity, this need for a basic sense of acceptance and connection. And so, then, conversely, the greatest desire that we have, no matter how we express it, no matter how we understand it, no matter how it manifests physically in our lives, is the need for acceptance. The need to know that there's a place at the table for us. The need to know that at the end of all things, there is something there that catches us, that knows us. Like Einstein said, the most important thing that his work as a physicist could teach him was whether the universe was a friendly place or not. Good old Einstein. Think about that for a second, though. What is he really saying? Exactly that. That there is something out there, unseen, underneath, undergirding, moving all things that we can measure with our instruments and our senses. Not only is it there, but it knows us. And not only does it know us, but it cares about us. Has our best interest at heart, is friendly. These are basic needs. Without these being met, we're a fearful people. We're a dysfunctional people. And that's what we so much see so often in life. We talked about it last week in terms of a woman running and seeing a snake on the path and calling her husband and not getting the support that she got, that she wanted from him. Just getting the, jump over it. Poke it with a stick. Get it out of the way. When what she really wanted was a basic sense of connection. That fear that we have. Just to get it just assuaged a little bit. You know? Another woman that I was counseling told me that she was remembering a time back when she was in grad school. And she was away from home for the first time going to school. And she just was feeling overwhelmed. She didn't know if she could do the program. She was just at her wit's end and feeling that desperation that you feel sometimes. So what did she do? She called her mom. Mom, I don't think I can do this anymore. It's just too much. Wondering what her mother was going to say. And she said, okay, honey, it's all right. If you want to come home, you can come home and we'll figure it out. If you want to stay, that's okay too. And that's all she needed to hear. She needed permission to fail. That it was okay to fail, that she still had a place at table, that mom still loved her, that she could come home, and there wouldn't be any recriminations, there wouldn't be this or that. And of course, that's all she needed to succeed, was the permission to fail. And so she was able to go on, and she got her master's, and she was fine. But she needed that connection. She needed that time. What we talked about last week, and what I want to pick up on this week, is that this ability of ours to look into another person's eyes and see what they really need and not what they're asking for, not what they're stating, not what they're acting out about, but to see their real needs and to be motivated, compassionate enough to actually act, to do something, no matter how small, for those needs, to meet those needs. That concern, that caring, that action is our first step to salvation. It is our salvation. Now, wait a minute. You know, you theologists out there, theologians, are thinking, well, salvation is a free gift. It's based on faith. You know, you don't do anything for it. Well, how do you define salvation? I'll tell you how I define salvation. Salvation is being with God. Being in God, being in Christ. Is that not salvation? Either here and now or there and then. Admission to heaven, being with God, in God. How in the world can we be with God or in God if we don't know who He is? How does that work? How can you be connected to something if you don't understand what that thing is? And here's a problem. We as a people and we as individuals don't know who we are. We have lost the sense of identity. We think we're this, that, and the other thing, but we don't know who we are because we don't know who God is. That basic insecurity that is not getting assuaged, that basic fear that is not dissipating, is all the proof that we need that we don't know who our God is. Because if we knew, if we had the slightest clue, we would know that everything is going to be all right. That the universe is a friendly place. That we can relax. That no matter how difficult things get, they're going to be all right in the end. In counseling, and it seems like counseling kind of ebbs and flows with me. I don't know what it is. You know, I don't solicit for counseling, but sometimes it gets really, really heavy. Like right now, there's been a lot of counseling. And you hear so many stories. You hear so much pain, so much confusion. So many people in desperate straits. And as you're talking to these people, you get a sense that no matter how it plays out, whether they're teenagers or whether they're older or whether they're married or single or whatever the circumstances are, it's like a funnel that brings you right back to that same place and that same question. What are you afraid of? If you can answer that question, you can get a handle on what it is that's driving all the craziness in your life, all the chaos. And so I keep going back to that with these people. 17-year-old girl that I was talking to just last week just kind of blurts out that she was raped last March, the way that she would say that she had spaghetti for dinner last night. It wasn't even the reason that she came to talk to me. There were all these other reasons that she talked about first. And here's this big thing there that she hasn't even begun to process. You know, it's coloring who she thinks she is, and she doesn't even realize it. So I ask her, if I ask you, this girl, who are you? What would you respond? Who are you? She had no response. She couldn't even formulate an answer to that question. There's a 26-year-old man that I was talking to last week as well, asked him the same question, who are you? And no response. 51-year-old woman that I was talking to also last week, who are you? Well, I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a quilter. I like to quilt, she says, and I read a lot. This is the typical way that we respond to this question, who am I? We respond with our roles, we respond with our relationships, we respond with our accomplishments. You know, we respond with our talents and the things, our skills that we have acquired. All those things, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a trash collector, I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm a musician. You know, I'm president of the United States. Is that who we are? That's what we talk about. That's what we say. But we don't know who we really are. And if you had asked me that question 15 or 20 years ago, I think I've said it in here 100 times, not only could I not answer the question, I would have been just as tongue-tied as that 17-year-old. I didn't even know what the question meant. What does it mean, who am I? Now I realize that there are two things in life that every human being must have in order to walk this path toward the dissipation of insecurity and fear that gives us the freedom to be able to choose in real time the things that are the best for everyone around us, and that's meaning and purpose. You've heard it over and over again, I'm sure. But what does that even mean, meaning and purpose? Well, I think it means meaning, who am I? Purpose, why am I here? Two questions. If I can answer those questions to my own satisfaction, not to yours or anybody else's, if I can answer those two questions, who am I and why am I here, I'm starting to get a handle on what it is going on. Without answering these, we're just lost, just insecure. Do you remember a movie called City Slickers? Love that movie. You know, it's kind of about the same thing. Men in midlife crisis, city slickers, city folk going out to do a cattle drive, thinking that maybe out there they can feel like men. You know, they can regain something that they lost. Talking about testosterone last week. So, you know, it's all there. It's, you know, on this drive, there is a trail boss You know, his name is Curly, kind of ironically. And he is the antithesis of everything that these city slickers are. Billy Crystal calls him a saddlebag with eyes. You know, he's so weathered and so tough. At one point, he and Curly go off together to do something or other. I forget what it is. And, you know, Billy Crystal is whining on about all the things in his life that drove him to this, all the difficulties facing in his urban environment and his marriage and his job and all these things. Finally, Curly looks at him and says, you know, you city slickers, you city folk, you worry about a lot of stuff. You want to know what the meaning of life is? You want to know what the secret of life is? Yeah. And he holds up his finger. Your finger? No. One thing. One thing. You focus on that, and the rest don't mean nothing. But what's the one thing? And he smiles and he says, that's what you got to figure out. Focus on the one thing, and the rest doesn't matter. You know, he was channeling Jesus, wasn't he? What did Jesus say right here? Matthew 6:33, seek first his kingdom. Whose kingdom? The Father's kingdom. The kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. And his righteousness, God's righteousness, which is what? What is the righteousness of God? Except for the connection and the acceptance and the caring and the love that is his nature. Kingdom, love and acceptance, seek that first. And all these things will be added to you. One thing. And the rest doesn't matter because it will come if we seek first the things that are most important. I was enamored with an author by the name of Viktor Frankl. Are any of you familiar with Viktor Frankl? He was a Jewish, he was so many things. He was a physician, he was a neurologist, he was a psychologist and psychiatrist. He is credited with a third of the three Viennese schools of psychology after Freud and Adler. And he came up with an idea of psychology called logotherapy. Logo being that Greek word that means word, but also means meaning or the underlying rationale for everything that exists. Logotherapy. Because his belief was that man's basic desire was to seek meaning. And without meaning, we're lost. Sound familiar? He wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. He was an Austrian Jew. And during World War II, he was taken by the Gestapo. After only being married a year, he was married in 1941, he was taken with his wife and his parents to the concentration camps. And there he learned some valuable lessons about meaning and about everything that he was doing. And he writes in this book both about his experiences at these camps, ultimately at Auschwitz, and then his thoughts about logotherapy and about what meaning can do for people in a therapeutic session or just in life. And he writes, in terms of asking a person what the meaning of life is, the who am I question, he says, I doubt whether a doctor can answer this question in general terms. For the meaning of life differs from man to man or woman to woman, from day to day, from hour to hour. What matters, therefore, is not the meaning of life in general, but rather the specific meaning of a person's life at a given moment. To put the question in general terms would be comparable to the question posed to a chess champion. Tell me, master, what is the best move in the world? There is simply no such thing as the best or even a good move apart from a particular situation in a game and the particular personality of one's opponent. The same holds for human existence. One should not search for an abstract meaning of life. As each situation in life represents a challenge to man and presents a problem for him to solve, the question of the meaning of life may actually be reversed. Ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather he must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To life, he can only respond by being responsible. Interesting. He can only respond by being responsible. She can only respond by being responsible. This emphasis on responsibleness is reflected in the categorical imperative of logotherapy, which is, and listen to this maxim, live life as if you were living already for the second time. and as if you had acted the first time as wrongly as you are about to act now. Okay. I know, it just goes right past, right? Think about it for a second. Live as if you were living already for the second time, and as if you had acted the first time as wrongly as you're about to act now. It seems to me that there is nothing which would stimulate a man's or a woman's sense of responsibleness more than this maxim, which invites him to imagine first that the present is past, and second, that the past may yet be changed and amended. Such a precept confronts him with life's finiteness as well as the finality of what he makes out of both his life and himself. You know, it's almost like you're trying to live your life like a flashback, like deja vu. If you can see, become aware. What he's talking about is mindfulness, awareness in the moment, to see the effect that your actions are going to have on everything and everyone that is around you. To be able to make that choice, not just in an unthinking, knee-jerk reaction. So many of us go through life asleep as if we're in a dream, not realizing that we can wake up in the dream and we can control our choices. We can actually make different choices. By declaring that man is responsible and must actualize the potential meaning of his life, I wish to stress that the true meaning of life is to be discovered in the world rather than in man and his own psyche, as though it were a closed system. Being human always points and is directed to something or someone other than oneself. Be it a meaning to fulfill, another human being to encounter, the more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause to serve or another person to love, the more human he is and the more he actualizes himself. What is called self-actualization is not an attainable aim at all, for the simple reason that the more one would strive for it, the more he would miss it. In other words, self-actualization is possible only as a side effect of self-transcendence. And there's a lot of big words in there, I realize that. And you have the disadvantage of just hearing this go by you, but what is he really saying? He's saying that we need to move beyond ourselves. And he's channeling Jesus as well. What did Jesus say at Matthew 16:25? For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Exactly the same idea. You see, our meaning, our purpose, our fulfillment as human beings, our who am I, our why am I here, our salvation is really a byproduct of living our lives this way. Awaken our moments, caring for one another, living for something larger than ourselves, a power greater than ourselves. This is everything that's going on. Why would that be so? Why would it be this byproduct of living this way? Why that when we go for it directly, it eludes us so much when we try to take it by the throat and make it ours, like everything else that we plan for and go for and try to accomplish? Why is it in this relationship of concern and care and action that we find out who we are? Because that's who God is. Who is God? God is love. God is acceptance. God is forgiveness. God is deliverance. When we experience those things in our relationship, we're experiencing God. There is no middle ground. There is no middle man here. When we move into those moments, we are experiencing all that God is, the acceptance and the love that we know exists because we have seen it. And we will never know who we are until we start to understand who God is and that there is a choice. How in the world are we going to find this out? How does this whole thing work? I want to read you a story, and it's a little bit longer, out of the same book from Viktor Frankl, but just sit back, even close your eyes for a minute, and try to picture the scene that he is laying out for us. It's a story from his time at Auschwitz, at the concentration camps. And he leads off by saying, in spite of all the enforced physical and mental primitiveness of the life in a concentration camp, it was possible for spiritual life to deepen. The sort of person the prisoner became was the result of an inner decision and not the result of camp influences alone. Fundamentally, therefore, any person can, even under such circumstances, decide what shall become of him or her, mentally, spiritually. They may retain human dignity even in a concentration camp. In order to make myself clear, I am forced to fall back on personal experience. Let me tell what happened on those early mornings when we had to march to our work site. There were shouted commands. Detachment, forward march, left, two, three, four, left, two, three, four, left, two, three, four. First man about, left and left and left and left, caps off. These words sound in my ears even now. At the order, caps off, we passed the gate of the camp and searchlights were trained upon us. Whoever did not march smartly got a kick, and worse off was the man who, because of the cold, had pulled his cap back on over his ears before permission was given. We stumbled on in the darkness over big stones and through large puddles along the road leading from the camp. The accompanying guards kept shouting us and driving us with the butts of their rifles. Anyone with very sore feet supported himself on his neighbor's arm. Hardly a word was spoken. The icy wind did not encourage talk. Hiding his mouth behind his upturned collar, the man marching next to me whispered suddenly, "If our wives could see us now, I do hope they are better off in their camps and don't know what is happening to us." That brought thoughts of my own wife to mind. And as we stumbled on for miles, slipping on icy spots, supporting each other time and time again, dragging one another up and onward, nothing was said. But we both knew. Each of us was thinking of his wife. Occasionally, I looked at the sky where the stars were fading and the pink light of the morning was beginning to spread behind a dark bank of clouds. But my mind clung to my wife's image, imagining it with an uncanny acuteness. I heard her answering me, saw her smile, her frank and encouraging look. Real or not, her look was then more luminous than the sun, which was beginning to rise. A thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers. The truth that love is the ultimate and highest goal to which man can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world still may know bliss, be it only for a brief moment in the contemplation of his beloved. In a position of utter desolation, when man cannot express himself in positive action, when his only achievement may consist in enduring his suffering in the right way, an honorable way, in such a position man can, through loving contemplation of the image he carries of his beloved, achieve fulfillment. For the first time in my life, I was able to understand the meaning of the words, "The angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of an infinite glory." In front of me, a man stumbled, and those following him fell on top of him. The guard rushed over and used his whip on them all. Thus, my thoughts were interrupted for a few minutes, but soon my soul found its way back from the prisoner's existence to another world. And I resumed talk with my loved one. I asked her questions and she answered. She questioned me in return and I answered. "Stop!" We had arrived at our work site. Everybody rushed into the dark hut in the hope of getting a fairly decent tool. Each prisoner got a spade or a pickaxe. "Can't you hurry up, you pigs?" Soon we had resumed the previous day's positions in the ditch. The frozen ground cracked under the point of the pickaxes and sparks flew. The men were silent, their brains numb. My mind still clung to the image of my wife. A thought crossed my mind. I didn't even know if she were still alive. I knew only one thing, which I have learned well by now. Love goes very far beyond the physical person of the beloved. It finds its deepest meaning in spiritual being, inner self. Whether or not he or she is actually present, whether or not he or she is still alive at all, ceases somehow to be of importance. I did not know whether my wife was alive. I had no means of finding out. During all my prison life, there was no outgoing or incoming mail. But at that moment, it ceased to matter. There was no need for me to know. Nothing could touch the strength of my love, my thoughts, and the images of my beloved. Had I known then that my wife was dead, I think that I would still have given myself, undisturbed by that knowledge, to the contemplation of her image, and that my mental conversation with her would have been just as vivid, just as satisfying. Set me like a seal upon thy heart. Love is as strong as death. And his wife was dead. Yeah. He was in the camps for 3 years, and she didn't make it out. His parents didn't make it out. He was the only one who made it out. Do you see what's happening here? The intensity of the suffering has caused him to understand something that were just words before. He'd heard these words over and over again in songs, in poetry, in philosophy. Maybe he'd even said them to others, especially as a psychologist, as a psychiatrist. But only now does he understand. Only now does it become real to him. Does he know what it is that animates every human being? Does he know what it is that is at the center of creation? When the suffering has stripped away everything that we cling to, everything that covers over and clouds the issues, can he become aware that he has a choice? And what is that choice? It's a choice whether or not to be a victim anymore. That's what the choice is. What do you think a victim is? Do you have a good working definition? Probably what you would say is a victim is someone who has been perpetrated against, who has been harmed in some way, you know, held against their will. They're a victim of circumstances, they're a victim of this or that. I think the real quality of a victim that stands out a victim from anything else is that a victim does not have a choice. A victim has no responsibility for their situation and for what's going on in their lives. But what we're finding out here, what Viktor Frankl found out at the camps, is that we always have a choice. Always. And if our external circumstances are such that they have paralyzed us, have incapacitated us, even in the eyes of an external observer, we are now victimized, there is still a choice. It's just the choice turns inward instead of outward. We can't change our circumstances, but we can change ourselves within the circumstances. How? By moving into that moment. By realizing what it is that is included in that moment. The image of the beloved. The image of the person that makes everything worthwhile. We can't be fully human. We can't be fully saved and be a victim at the same time. Can you see that? We hold on to our victimhood so long after the perpetration has ceased. It's comforting not to have any responsibility, isn't it? It's comforting to have no choice, not to be responsible if you fail. To not to have to try to get up and try again. And so we hang on to that position even though the moment has passed. And even while we are being victimized, we can still choose something else. And our responsibleness, our choice, brings us to know who God is and who we are. And there's that thing about suffering that brings us to the point of meaning. Frankl tells one more story when he was back in Vienna after the war and resuming his practice. An elderly man, an MD, a general practitioner, comes in to see him because he can't get over this severe depression because his wife died 2 years earlier and he loved her above all else. And he can't get over and he can't find a will to live. And Frankl thinks, what am I going to tell him? There's nothing here that can be changed. It's an immutable situation. It is what it is. So instead he asks him a question. He says, what would it have been like if you had died first? And he says, oh, my wife never would have been able to handle it. She would have suffered so greatly. He says, well, then in a very real way, you have spared her that suffering by simply outliving her at the expense of your own suffering. And that man didn't say a word. He shook his hand, he left the office, and he never came back. Because any suffering, as long as it is imbued with meaning, in this case, the meaning of sacrifice for his wife, becomes not only bearable, but noble, and not only noble, but significant, and it brings us ever closer to this understanding of who we are, because we're understanding who our Father is. Without that crucible, without that stripping away, we never really get down to where we need to get to understand these things. Without that crucible, we can stay trivial, childish, and silly people who don't really understand what is going on in the lives around us. One of my favorite writers, one of my mentors, was Brennan Manning. In fact, our little six-year-old is named after Brennan. And he writes in a book called Ruthless Trust, which I recommend to every one of you, about a time of another person's writer, a friend of his. When Paul Metzbarger recalls the time he and his wife visited New Orleans for a spring vacation, like most tourists, they roamed the French Quarter the first day. As they turned the corner onto Royal Street, a woman darted in their direction. She was dressed professionally except for a pair of tennis shoes. With a gaudy smile, she said, "I knew immediately that you were saved." Flummoxed by the intrusion and unfamiliar with evangelical jargon, Paul mumbled, "Well, I hope so." The woman blocked their attempt to pass. "Isn't it wonderful?" she cried. "Don't you just feel the rapture is coming?" Puzzled, the couple made no reply. The woman then referred to the rising tensions in a number of Eastern European countries that seemed to be stumbling toward chaos. She interpreted the escalation of international conflict as a sure sign of impending nuclear war, a war that would hasten the end of the world, at which point the elect would be summoned to heaven by direct bodily transport. Metzbarger had this to say about her. Wrapped in the folds of an invincible complacency, this child woman sweetly voiced a message of unspeakable filth, celebrating mass destruction, because certain of us, by divine decree, would be carved out and lifted up to enjoy eternal happiness. And then the kicker. As I was searching for some suitably hurtful riposte, she thrust a paper into my hand and said that if we would only attend a one-hour presentation at the office of a condominium developer, we could have a free breakfast at the Court of the Two Sisters on Bourbon Street. Talk about oblivious. Likewise, Anne Donovan, after the delivery of her stillborn child, heard only mocking laughter from the heavens when a well-intentioned friend recited a saccharine poem with this gruesome message. God had looked around heaven and decided that it needed some brightening up, so he plucked a vivid flower, her stillborn baby, to cheer the place up. She said, "I just clenched my teeth to keep from saying something I'd regret." The bromides, platitudes, and exhortations to trust God from nominal believers who have never visited the Valley of Desolation are not only useless, they are textbook illustrations of unmitigated gall. Only someone who has been there, who has drunk the dregs of our cup of pain, who has experienced the existential loneliness and alienation of the human condition, dares whisper the name of the Holy to our unspeakable distress. Only that witness is credible. Only that love is believable. If we haven't gone through it, it is difficult for us to understand. But even then, if we haven't gone through something, we can't even enter into another's pain. We only repeat what we have heard secondhand. We throw these things about as if they have any meaning at all. We aren't looking into the eyes of the suffering person and seeing who they are and seeing what they need and realizing that at some points in human connection, there are no words. And you simply just be together. You let them cry. You hold on to them for dear life. Some things can't be fixed. But in the moment of finding meaning, they can not only be endured, but they can tell us who we are and start to tell us who God is. It seems that We have to suffer in some way to start to understand this. Frankl suffered, of course, in the concentration camps. Brennan Manning suffered greatly in his life. But by choosing to reconnect, by choosing love over disconnection, we choose no longer to be a victim. And we choose to love, and we choose God in that love. I was talking to a woman, another one, in the session, and she confessed to me that there is an online man that she has met that she has this chat relationship with. And she hastened to tell me, you know, it's not anything, you know, we haven't done anything, but she's married, and she's having a difficult time with her marriage. And she saw this as a harmless thing, just something that, you know, just kind of kept her going 24 hours to 24 hours, you know. Innocent enough at some level, but at some level she knew that there was something wrong. And I said, do you see what's happening here? This relationship is allowing you to maintain your distance from your spouse. You get just enough over here in this artificial, unreal situation in order to get by and not do the work that you need to do to reconnect with your living, breathing spouse. And it really has nothing to do with this other person that shows up, you know, in digital form on the screen. It's an image in your mind that you're comparing a real-life person to, and nobody can compete with an idealized image in your mind. No flesh and blood man or woman can ever compete. You will never, ever get what you're seeking. The very thing that you're doing to get what you're seeking is what keeps you from what you really need, which is the connection, the acceptance. We have this little 7-year-old boy that lives next door, and he plays with our 6-year-old. And you know, there's just something about him that I don't like. God help me. He just annoys me. And, you know, some of you are old enough to remember Leave It to Beaver. Do you remember the Eddie Haskell character in Leave It to Beaver? He was a kid who was doing all the dirty dealing in the background, but as soon as he came up to the parents, it was, "Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Cleaver." And this kid is kind of like that, you know. He'll be downstairs and I can hear him and he's baiting our son or making him cry and doing all these things. And of course he comes up and then it's like, you know, hello. And it's kind of like Bill Cosby said, kids don't realize that sound carries, you know. I'm hearing all this stuff. But what I realized, all of a sudden it just struck me this week, is that every time this kid comes over, I'd have that feeling and I wouldn't give him eye contact. He'd come up and try to talk to me and I'd mumble something in reply and kind of go the other way. And I realized I'm doing the same thing. I'm letting my feelings, he's a 7-year-old kid for crying out loud, I'm letting my feelings keep me separate from him, keep me at arm's length from him. And so the last few times that he's been over, I've just gone the other way, you know. Hi, how you doing? Good to see you. What's going on? Engage him in conversation, or if he comes to me, answer him back. And it's helping, you know. The knife doesn't go in quite as far. Doesn't twist quite as much. But this is what we do. This is what we do. We keep ourselves distant because of the pain we feel, because of the hurt we feel. We find idealized fantasy things that will keep us going. We stay in our righteous place, in our self-righteous anger, stay separate, unforgiving, unwilling to accept that which already is. And it only hurts us. It hurts who we are. What did Jesus say? Matthew 7, do not judge so that you will not be judged. For the way that you judge, you will be judged, and your standard of measure will be measured to you. What is he telling us? Don't stand outside the flow of humanity and think that you're other than, that you can be subject and object with the rest of humanity. You are, we are humanity. We are each other. There is no difference between us. We are all the same. We are all in the boat together. You know, it is just the height of unreality to think that we are not each other, that we aren't feeling the same things, going through the same things. I had a young man ask me last week, again, in sort of a counseling session, and he said, how do you stay humble if someone is coming and asking you for help? Doesn't that sort of by definition imply that you're better than they are? Well, then how do you stay humble? How do you stay on an even keel with them? What I told him was is that I remember these words from one of the monks who taught me in high school, Brother Kowalewski. I still remember him. He said, any man, and you can read here, any woman, is capable of the utmost folly at any given moment. Put it on your refrigerator. Tattoo it somewhere where you can see it. We are all capable of the utmost folly at any given moment. Brennan Manning again, a Franciscan priest who had been all over the world doing ministry work. He finds himself sitting on a curbstone along General Meyer Avenue in New Orleans. I am intoxicated, he writes, after a relapse with alcohol. My clothes are in tatters. I reek with rancid body odor. I am unshaven. My face and belly are bloated. My eyes bloodshot. I am clutching a fifth of Smirnoff vodka. Only a few ounces left. My marriage is collapsing. My friends are near despair, and my honor is broken. My brain is scrambled. My mind is a junkyard of broken promises, failed dreams, unkept resolutions. 50 yards behind me is the detox center of F. Edward Herbert Hospital. As I take the last swig, I shudder at the pain and heartache I have caused. Going to AA meetings, working the 12 steps, talking to my sponsor, reading the big book, praying. These have all worked for others. Why have they not worked for me? I know I will never hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant. Minor panic, no more booze. Reaching in my pocket, I find a $5 bill. Staggering down 4 blocks, I find a convenience store, still open at midnight. I buy a pound of Taka vodka, cheaper. I retrace my steps, weaving across the avenue to reclaim my seat on the curb. I do not want the life-saving treatment of detox. I continue drinking. My eyes fill with tears. Now I am crying. Abba's drunken child. Jesus, where are you? Soon I pass out with a half-full pint resting on my chest. When I wake up the next morning, I learn that 2 staff members have come out on the avenue and carried me into detox. We are all 1 step away from that curb. We are all 1 step away from each other. If at a moment I can reach and out and help somebody else, in the next moment someone has to reach out and help me. There is no difference. Humility is only the realization of reality as it is, that we're all the same. That we're all loved the same. That we can connect on that level. And when we do connect on that level, something happens. We start to understand who God is, and we start to understand who we are. Who are you? Can you answer that question? Do you know what the question even means? Why are you here? If you can't answer the first question, you can't answer the second question. And I can tell you now, after 15 years of working through this, I'm starting to understand who I am. I can tell you what I think it means, but it'll just be words to you. And you can hear the words and you can agree with them and your head can go up and down and you can assent mentally to what I say or what somebody else says, and then you can repeat them to somebody else. But if you haven't experienced it, it will be just as inauthentic as the woman with the condominium handout, or the one trying to comfort her grieving friend who had a stillborn child. It has to come from the very depths of who we are. Who we are has no relevance until we know who God is and have experienced that thing. Once again, just to recap, Viktor Frankl, a thought transfixed me. For the first time in my life, I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers, the truth that love is the ultimate and the highest goal to which man can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world may still know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved, in a position of utter desolation, when man cannot express himself in a positive action, when his only achievement may consist in enduring his suffering in the right way, the honorable way. In such a position, man can, through loving contemplation of the image he carries of his beloved, achieve fulfillment. For the first time in my life, I was able to understand the meaning of the words, the angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of his glory. God is love. forgiveness, salvation, redemption. And when He created us, He used the same stuff. We are made of the same stuff. We are the manifestation of God's love. We are that stuff that God is. And the moment that we understand that is the moment that we begin our journey home, our journey to salvation, our fearless ability to give to others as God has given to us. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for giving everyone the ability to sit long enough with me this morning. Thank you for the sense of your presence 2 o'clock this morning and right now this morning. You are exactly who your Son said you are. Help us to not just understand that with our minds, but to feel it in action and experience every single day. You are who you say you are. We need to know that deeper and deeper, Father, so that we can let go more and more of the fear that we feel, the separation and the aloneness we feel, and come back to you in more and more profound ways. We love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Let's all stand.